Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Cinephiles Live here on the Cinephiles YouTube channel. I am John Rocha here, excited to be welcoming my co-host on the Cinephiles here for a fun conversation and our first live show of 2025, Steve Morris. How are you, Steve?
I'm doing good, and man, it is hard to adjust to 2025. Every year, yeah. There's that little, I have to write a check or something. It's like, man, 2025, it's crazy to think we're there.
It's you're right. I mean, just the idea of like the one thing you were worried about, oh, I hope I get the year right. There's so much more to worry about now going into 2025 right off the bat. I mean, you have to say it's been a very eventful last 2 weeks with a lot of stuff that's been going on in our state of California, but also in other places of the world, along with other places here in the United States. So we initially, just to let you all know, we initially were going to do a best of 2024. What are we looking forward to in 2025? But in light of what has been going on over the last few days in California with the fires and with the responses to the fires and people, just a general overall feeling of despondency that's kind of been just out in the air since that time, Steve and I adjusted to do more about talking about films that we turn to, or films that show us what we can do in times of crisis. But we thought we'd start with talking about the fires first and then move into that. So, Steve, where are you right now in terms of everything that's happening? I know you're in a certain area of LA. I'm in San Diego, so I'm more of an observer on this. So talk to me about where you're at with the fires. What was your experience? What was your first hint that something was happening, and how have the last few days been for you watching this and monitoring this from your home?
So first of all, I'm okay. I'm safe. There have been people that have reached out online, which I really appreciate. I do live, as you know, my house is in the hills. It is a valley that comes straight up to my house that when the winds get big, it's like a wind tunnel. Mm-hmm. And so I have a big empty hill below me. Fortunately, we had our brush cleared this summer, so things were relatively knocked down, but that first night it was scary. I can't begin to describe how powerful the winds were. I was looking at the trees around my house going, any one of these could fall down. The windows were shaking, my son was scared, and then when the news of the fire, we literally could see the Eaton fire from my dining room window, and it was big that first night. It was really scary to see. That's the fire up in Altadena.
What night was that? Can you say what night that was? Was it Tuesday, Wednesday? What night was that for you?
Wednesday night, I think.
And had you heard about the fires ahead of time or anything that was going on? Or was this your first kind of exposure to it all?
First thing was that I saw it on the hill across the way. I'd heard about the Palisades fire. But right. The first thing I saw was the Altadena fire was literally on the hill across the way. And watching and going, that's not a small fire. Like, you have seen fires on that hill before, but this was a big fire. And the second night was scary too. The winds weren't as bad, but then there had been another fire that's in Elysian Park that's fairly close to me. Yeah. Got put out really quickly, fortunately. But I mean, where my house is, I live in a 100-year-old wood house at the top of a hill with screaming winds sometimes coming up, and one cigarette thrown by the side of the road could below my house could be up to all the way up the hill within minutes. And so it was scary, and I had to have we got one evacuation warning, which ended up being an error, but I had my bag is still packed by the door. And there was the moment on the second night, which I think is Thursday, where I had to like say to my son, listen, this is what's going to happen. If we get an evacuation order, this is how it's going to go. And it freaked him out, understandably so. And he has two friends from school who lost their homes.
Completely.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. And we know other people have lost apartment and other people have lost homes. like this is no, this is nothing small. This is a big deal. And it has been genuinely scary. And, you know, my house is covered in ashes. It smells like smokes. The air quality is low. Like, it's been rough, but I'm safe. And at this moment, there isn't anything threatening my house, which is really good.
That's good. And have you been keeping track on the stuff as it's been progressing through certain areas? And now what, the last I had checked up on it, it had moved, one of the fires that started in Woodland Hills, and it was moving towards Encino. And so there was multiple places where these fires popped up and were blowing because of the winds blowing those sparks all over the place. Yeah.
I mean, it's the wind that's really the scariest part of all this. Yeah. Yes, I've been trying to do the thing of keeping up.
Yes.
Without keeping myself crazy, you know?
Right.
Because you can become such a news junkie and look at every little detail. And there's also, particularly if you were to get your news from social media, which for this,
oh, God.
Like, yeah. On the one hand of, like, seeing an update of this is where this fire is.
Yeah.
You know, social media can be the best for that. It's really fast. Get information right away. That's great. But then there's all this stuff getting thrown around that I see people with all these explanations for what's happening where we really don't know. We do not know yet. And the biggest thing that people who want to put some narrative on it, like it's, you know, it's arsons who are attacking Los Angeles or it's this or it's that, whatever it is. It's like, the biggest thing it was unbelievably powerful winds after a very wet year and a dry summer. Yeah. And that made circumstances that made the fire catch as quickly as it did and spread as quickly as it did. That's the big thing. Any other details and conspiracy theories are secondary to what is a major natural disaster. It is a natural disaster. That's what happened.
Yeah. As always, you know, when these things happen lately, nowadays in our world of social media and where everyone gets a voice and everyone whips out their phones to record or to talk, it's a lot of misinformation that gets spouted. You're always surprised at how many armchair governors have just been sitting there who know everything that they would have done correctly in a situation like this. It's amazing how many armchair mayors are sitting around who would have totally responded perfectly to this situation. It's just all that stuff that you have to wade through to really find the people who are running towards the crisis to help. And I think that's what's important. When you put away all the people who are pontificating and trying to score political points and the disingenuous people who are trying to push ugly, toxic narratives, there are a lot of companies and there are a lot of people who are stepping up to help and support people who are suffering in LA and pushing aside the idea that it's just all celebrities being affected. It's a lot of people. Like, it's irrelevant to celebrities. Celebrities are still human beings. They still feel the things they feel, but it's a blue collar town, which is something a lot of people don't seem to want to accept. And there's a lot of people living paycheck to paycheck. There's a lot of people living 3 months away from a possible homelessness. There's a lot of people who are living on the edge in LA trying to survive because the cost of living has gone up so much as well. And the wages haven't necessarily matched. So there's a lot of people who are affected by these fires who are going to be hurt by it in the long run. So to see all these people stepping up with these massive drives and trying to raise money, and we see the lines for the trying to help the pets, stuff of that nature, I think that's all wonderful stuff to see the reaction from people in LA.
I mean, so first of all, I think from what I've seen, and I've watched several press conferences from the LA city, from the fire department, police, school board, all of them, and it has been universally, in my opinion, a bunch of people working really, really hard trying to do the right thing under very, very difficult circumstances.
Yeah.
And so, like, does that mean that they've done everything perfectly? Of course they haven't.
Yeah, right.
Of course, no group does everything perfectly. And the big thing, I think, is that, like, there's such a rush to, A, assign blame,
yes,
like, before we know the facts, and B, to assign that blame based on whatever political structure framework that you have about the world. Oh, these are the people that I don't like, therefore it must be their fault. Or these are the people I don't like, therefore it must be their fault. And it's like, assigning blame is all well and good, but it doesn't solve problems. Like, that's not what we need. Like, you need, like, sure, assigning blame might be one step in solving problems, but the big thing is, how do you get these resources to these people? And people that are busting their asses trying to solve problems are way more important and valuable to me than the people that are out there trying to assign blame. Like, that's just a huge difference.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, it's been great to see these organizations pop up. I mean, I know Airbnb has created a, you could go stay for a week in one of their places if you are from a displaced home. Uber was offering free rides, I think, for 48 hours to people to get out of the fire. There's been a lot of money coming in to support people. I'm really surprised at how many organizations are not donating at this time. Someone put up a graphic where Amazon, Google, Microsoft, all these people have not donated yet to help with the situation with the fires, as far as I can see. And so you're just kind of surprised by that. And you, what you want to do is rally, and you hope Americans come together to help a city, a very legendary city, by the way, in a state that is important to a lot of other states, for it to stay alive financially and what have you. And I think this is what's shocked me about this whole thing, is just seeing how there's been so many disingenuous people trying to muddy the water here, when we should be all coming together to help in situations like this. And I watching it from afar, my heart breaks for everybody who's enduring this. You know, that was my city for 20 years. So I'm very much still in love with that city. Whatever my gripes or issues may be with that city, I still very much love that city. So seeing a lot of my friends having to evacuate, getting scared, moving to different locations to try to stay out of it. And as you said, we know friends who've lost houses, and hearing what they've been experiencing. It's just all been devastating to see. But I agree with you. I do see a lot of people in the government trying to do what's right, trying to work all day and all night to try to fix it, to try to get people in better positions, try to find where the water is, trying to get that out to places and stop it. And the firefighters, the first responders, who are at times working 24 hours a day to stop this stuff, have not been getting fed regularly, are having trouble sleeping, right, when they do get a chance to sleep. So there's a lot here that's involved, but there's a lot of people on the front line who are sacrificing of themselves to try to contain these fires. And they've done incredible work over the last few days to make that happen. And that's kind of the point of the show here. We want to talk about is, like, what do movies show us in crisis? How do we react to crisis and things of that nature? And so what have you been seeing, Steve, from, you know, aside from everything we just talked about, what have you been seeing from people in the rallying and the getting stuff together and supporting people? What have you been seeing from the side, from your vantage point?
I think it's always better when we're in the world of local than versus the world of national. Mm. Because when it's local, when it's just like, okay, there's this neighborhood right over there, and there are a bunch of pets, and we got to figure out what to do with the pets, then people come together to solve that problem. When it becomes national, then we get divided up into these groups. And this is like the first thing that I was thinking, just as you've been speaking, is that if you need to decide what your level of sympathy is for a group based on their political affiliation or their level of wealth or any of those other factors in the midst of a national disaster, you have missed the point. Is that somebody, it's like, yeah, is Billy Crystal going to recover a lot more easily from losing his home than someone who's paycheck to paycheck? Yeah, Billy Crystal's a rich guy. He is going to be fine. But that doesn't mean that it's not his home that he raised kids in, that lived his life in, has his memories in, has his special, these photographs, all the things that he loves are gone. And that emotional level still is really, really shitty. Like, I don't look at the hurricane in North Carolina and the terrible flooding or South Carolina and go, oh, well, those people probably didn't vote the way I voted, so I shouldn't feel sympathetic for them. That's not how this works. It should be completely 100% agnostic. In the United States of America, when there is a natural disaster, we all care equally about those people and the horrible shit that they went through. That should be just the first thing. So I'm thinking about these movies of, like, we see, you know, it's funny. One of the ones that has popped up as we were talking was The Avengers. The Avengers is a classic movie of a team coming together to fight against a horrible alien invasion. And you see people who are manipulating the situation behind the scenes to service their own ends rather than work together in order to solve the problem. And that's, you know, the lesson of the movie is, like, you can't just be working for your side when you're trying to save the planet, you know?
Yeah. No, I know, and I think that's a great point you bring up, the Avengers, because we can even go further into the equation here with Avengers Endgame and seeing how people rallied from all different parts of the world, all different parts of all different walks of life, all different powers, all different types of approaches, points of views. Remember, that movie is happening right after the events of a civil war within the actual superhero world, where people have separated and gotten scared about what might happen here. And so there have been questions about the government, but they all come together at the end here because there is a threat to their existence, which is Thanos and his group of people that are coming here who want to essentially terraform the Earth for themselves. And that is a massive thing to confront. And these heroes aren't caught in like, well, who's helping? Who's the first person out on the line? Is he really Captain America, or is he Captain America for who he likes? You know, there's none of that. There's all coming together because we see that there's a threat that has to be handled. And so there are lessons within all of these movies of people coming together from different walks of life, even different points of view, seeing a situation that's going to threaten their very existence and not getting caught up in the political side of things, but rallying to help. And I think this is, you starting with the Avengers is a great choice, you know?
Well, and I hadn't thought of connected it with Civil War, but I think that what's so great about the way you frame that is Civil War is the perfect example of them not doing it the right way.
Yes.
Civil War is, we got caught into these ideological camps and then we had to fight each other. And of course, we're not really calculating how much damage is caused when Avengers decide to fight each other, but there's a lot of damage. It's real dangerous when Captain America and Iron Man are not getting along. They break a whole bunch of stuff. And that, I think that the lesson here is like, oh, it doesn't mean that when we're into Infinity War and Endgame that Captain America and Iron Man, that Tony and Steve are best buddies.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that Iron Man has forgiven Steve or forgiven Bucky. It doesn't mean that they're all real. Those conflicts still exist, but they're saying we have to get over this in order to save the planet. And that's where we are, I think, in the world right now of going, it's not saying, I like this thing that you're saying. I don't like it, but we still have to save the planet. Like we're not, you know, we're not facing Thanos. But we're facing heavy stuff in the world right now that has to be dealt with, you know?
And that's the thing that we need to see and embrace. But I think movies have helped us do that through the history of film, right? We've seen ourselves through movies for decades. We've seen how good we can be. Yes, there have been also movies where we see how bad we can be. Certainly that's an essential part of cinema, but we have seen movies where people come together. People like you look at something in a very micro way, like Remember the Titans, right? The Thanos essentially was racism in that movie, and they were looking at a situation here where they were gonna make a decision, where a school had a board or government had made a decision that this school was going to be integrated, and they were gonna have to figure it out how to work together, right? And it wasn't like one person came in, had all the answers, and was completely correct all the time. Boone makes mistakes in the movie in trying to put this together, as he would, as anybody would. And that's something we've kind of lost, too, is this idea of grace for the mistakes. As long as the intention is sound, there needs to be grace for mistakes or errors or people being caught unawares, because we are all caught unawares at times in life. So seeing it in Remember the Titans, they had come together. It's not initially an easy coming together, but eventually, step by step, they do come together. They figure it out because they realize they're stronger together than they are separated, bickering over political issues or the skin color of someone or something like that. And so I think those are important lessons that we need to go back to in times of crisis, and especially now when we see how divisive any situation that happens in our country, the divisiveness that follows quickly after in ways that never was the case before, Steve.
I couldn't agree more. And I think the statement you make about needing to give people grace for making mistakes, man, that is so important. And it's so not the way we operate, because we live in such a gotcha mentality in every way, you know? And so it's like everybody's waiting to pounce at the moment somebody screws up. Instead of, and it's like you go like, look, if you had two bosses, one boss who claimed to have never made a mistake and never admits to a mistake, and another boss who says, oh, I screwed that up, let's do better next time, or this is how I'm going to change, which do you want to be your boss? You know,
right?
And it was funny, like, and I know I was threatening to do this, and now I'm going to do exactly what I was threatening to, which is that I wanted to, when Jimmy Carter passed away, I texted you, I was still in Mexico at the time, and said, hey, I want to talk about Jimmy Carter. And one of the things that, as I've been listening to interviews with him and speeches with him and remembrances of him, he actually is the kind of character that we say we want as a leader.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. is that he is a person who did admit his mistakes. Yeah. He did say, when he said, I'm going to do everything I can not to lie to you, he really tried not to lie to the American people. And there are all sorts of things that we can say that he did wrong or that he wasn't prepared. And all that's in terms of his presidency, that's true. But he did get up, you know, the famous what's known as the malaise speech, even though he never says the word malaise. I encourage everybody to listen to it. It is one of the great speeches. It's called the Crisis of Confidence speech. And basically he says, hey, there are things that are being difficult in America, that is what's happening to Americans. And it's how they're feeling. It's that they're losing hope. They're losing faith in the institutions. They're losing all this stuff, which was all totally true. And he describes his part in it and the changes that he's going to make and how we have to do better. And it's like exactly what we say we want. We want an honest politician who's going to tell us the truth, who has the courage of his convictions, who has a strong moral system. That's all Jimmy Carter. And he's the guy we vote out. You know, like that's something we really need to look at, I think.
Yeah, you're not wrong. And I think this, you know, the thing is, when you look at it all, you're trying to find the person that you sense the intentions are authentic, right? And you want that person to succeed in unifying the country and doing what's best for the overall country, not just what's best for their political party or their point of view or the people that agree with them. Was the thing with Jimmy Carter was that he was trying to do what was best for the entire country. And yes, unfortunately, the oil situation happened. And then, of course, the hostages. And those were two. That's a 1-2 punch that essentially knocked Jimmy Carter out by the end. And you could argue that he was maybe just a little too honest, a little too nice, and a little less of a political animal than was necessary at the time, because we move into the 1980s with Reagan and the me generation and the yuppies and glorifying of wealth and cocaine and all this stuff that happens after Carter. And that's where we seem to go into this slide, which we still are in all these decades later, of a very much like, I'm going to protect mine. I don't want to share it with you. And I am going to enrich myself as much as possible to separate myself from everyone else. And so this is where we seem to have lost a little bit of what we were supposed to be as a country. And I still think we're capable of so much greatness. And when I watch these movies, I'm reminded, even though I know they're fantasies and what have you, but I'm reminded of how we can rally and seeing people rally over the last few days, seeing people setting up organizations, setting up websites overnight, setting up locations for people to donate. I've seen actors come out and say, hey, I got a large house. If you are displaced, DM me. Let's figure out. Let's get you. I've got rooms that you can stay in. So seeing people step up to the plate to help and assist, I think gives me hope that we can someday return back to a place of normalcy where we react together as a country, because I shudder to think how we would react to 9/11 today, right, as opposed to how we did in 2001, where a majority of people put away their anger towards Bush or Giuliani and came together to try to help what happened there in New York and in Pennsylvania and in DC. So I just wonder how we would react now when we're so politically and so invested in the political divide. I think would scare me, you know, because I want us to think we're better than that.
This is where I say, I think in the local situation, and most of the people on the ground, they're doing exactly the same thing.
Yeah,
as you saw, they're all the volunteers are still there, all the first responders are still there. Yeah. There are people donating blood right now. There are people doing all of those things that we do, you know, donating to causes, helping with shelters, donating to the Red Cross. I'm sure Doctors Without Borders and Doctors Without Borders, but World Central Kitchen and all those places are on the ground doing that work that they always do. It's the narrative up in the, you know, in the Twitter sphere and the blogosphere and on CNN where they're trying to make a story out of this stuff. And I think what's happened is, like, there was this, we talked about this a lot on the Cinephiles, is there was an essential American mythology. And that essential American mythology, starting with the Kennedy assassination, which we talked about when we talked about JFK, into Watergate, which we talked about when we talked about all the president's men, all the way through to today, is piece by piece has destroyed the myth of America, the great nation, that when it puts its mind to something, it can do anything. That is the myth, and that myth is as dead today as you could possibly imagine. It mostly is the opposite, is no trust whatsoever that we can actually accomplish what we set our mind to. And the fact is, we're still the same. We still can do these things.
Hello, Cinephiles fans. This is John for Hims. Listen, guys, we know that life can get stressful, and you have plenty to worry about without adding performance in the bedroom to your list. Hims provides access to treatments that can help you stay hard and last longer, giving you that boost of confidence so you can be ready whenever the mood strikes. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing you with access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. And look, the process is 100% online, so there's no need for uncomfortable doctor's visits. No insurance is needed, and one low price covers everything from treatments to ongoing care. With hundreds of thousands of trusted subscribers, Hims can help you find the ED option that works for you. So start your free online visit today at hims.com/cinephiles. That's hims.com/cinephiles for your personalized ED treatment options. hims.com/cinephiles. The products mentioned are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan.
I'd like to bring up, I think, maybe among the best working together to overcome adversity movies you could possibly imagine, and that is Apollo 13.
Oh, great point. Go ahead, please. Yes.
I mean, Apollo 13, and again, is there someone to blame for why they had this issue on the capsule? Yeah, there probably is. Did they spend any time talking about that in Apollo 13? Nope. Right. Spend all their time going, we have to figure out how to get these people home. Right. It is everybody. Nobody's arguing about politics. Nobody's trying to get away with anybody. Everybody is just busting their ass to save this group of people. And it is that, to me, is that American mythology of like, we can do it. If we work together, we can solve any problem. And I think that we need to recapture that.
Even the person who was taken off the flight, right? Gary Sinise on the ground. He could have been caught up in his pride, could have been caught up in his own feelings of hurt and not wanting to help and saying, you know, F NASA or whatever. But no, even he was willing to swallow his pride, overcome his own maybe instincts to not want to help. And he helped in very important ways there on the ground. I agree with you. It's again, these are people in distress. There's no political point of view here. We're trying to save Americans who are caught up in a situation out in space. We all need to come together and figure that out. And you're right. All these different people there in NASA figuring it out and putting it together. And then the chances that are taken in order to make that happen. And it's amazing to witness when you watch the movie.
Yeah. I mean, part of it too is leadership is so important. This is where, this is where leadership matters. And Ed Harris in that movie is just like, we're going to bring these people home. And and he sets the tone. And this is, and I'll say, the leaders of both parties at this point have not always been great communicators in the way that we want. Like George W. Bush, not my favorite president in any way, but when he stood below the towers after 9/11 with that bullhorn in his hand, he brought America together. That's what, because every president, whether, you know, we talked about Carter and the Iran, the hostage crisis, you know, every president is going to face these moments.
Yeah.
And you're either going to decide to bring the country together or you're not. And when it gets real hard to solve the problem, if you don't bring all the resources of America together to solve it.
Yeah. And, you know, we see that, you know, not to get too, we're not going to get too political, but we have to deal with the facts and the reality. And, and President Biden has been very clear about helping California, the 6-month, 180-day thing where they're going to pay for 100% of everything. And people are trying to twist that, like, why don't you do that to North Carolina? They did it for North Carolina for 180 days. That's the standard response to these massive situations. It's what happens after the 180 days that is a different conversation. But what California got is exactly what North Carolina got. So you're seeing a president that is stepping up to the plate in these situations here. And I think, can you say, did he make mistakes, the election comments, all of that? That's a separate issue. Is a president showing up to help in times of crisis, and is a governor rallying to help in times of crisis? And it seems to me, from what I'm seeing, regardless of my political affiliation or approach or point of view, it seems like these are people who are genuinely trying to help. You know, they're not running off to Cancun in the middle of a snow situation in their respective states. They're staying there, you know, to help. And I think that's important to try to make that happen. When we go back to the previous presidency, I know I have my opinions and my points of views, but I would have given Trump all kinds of, I do give him credit for speeding up the getting the vaccines out there for COVID, which I thought was really important. I thought they were, how can I say this? I thought that they were on a unrealistic timeline when they first announced how quickly they were trying to get these vaccines approved and created and out there for people to use, but they got the job done. And so there is credit that can be given there. The problem is that it's also mixed in with someone who is pushing bleach or whatever nonsense and then trying to essentially intimate that only certain states were going to get the vaccine depending on the political point of view. And we're seeing that now where already people are coming out today from a certain side of the spectrum who are saying, well, we're not going to give money to California unless they show us exactly how they're going to spend it. And then it becomes very much partisan as opposed to helping everyone, because North Carolina wasn't threatened in that way by that side of the political spectrum. And that's where it becomes, to me, a frustrating situation, because I actually don't care where you side politically. When a big event happens, I care, are people stepping up? Are you stepping up to help? Are you being there? Are you donating? Are you, are you setting up drives? Are you being there as a representative of the government to help people? And so I like people coming together. And we've seen bipartisan stuff happen over the last 4 years in certain sections of the country when stuff happens. And certainly during Trump's presidency, we saw bipartisan stuff happening too, because it has to happen, because human lives are at stake. I felt that it was more of the predominant point of view as it had been in the past. And I hope we get ourselves back to a situation like that, you know?
So there, we have an adversarial political system that is based on the idea that two people or two parties or two groups fight it out. And then the one that wins is the one that gets to make the decisions.
Absolutely.
Yes. That's how the system works. And I think when it was invented and, you know, John Adams had to get on a horse or take a carriage to have a 4 or 5 day journey from Boston down to Philadelphia. Then you had, maybe they wrote letters back and forth, but they were just governing. Whereas today, every moment is politics, every single moment, and every single thing that everybody does can be put on a political scale of this either helps me or it hinders me, right? So I want to manipulate the news or use whatever news there is to help the Republican cause or help the Democratic cause. And I think the way that is infiltrated in every single moment of our life is extremely detrimental, in particular when facing a natural disaster or something like COVID or something like that, is that seeing every bit of COVID news or seeing a fire or a mass shooting or a flood or a hurricane or a tornado as something that can be weaponized to further your political ends is antithetical to solving the damn problem. Yeah. Like, it doesn't have anything to do with whether or not is that what happened with COVID was that masks and vaccines became politicized so that to use one or the other, rather than just being a part of science, rather than just being a part of like, oh, we, you know, there were things that and both sides totally did this. I would see people driving in their car alone with a mask on in California. And it's like, dude, what are you protecting yourself of? The research became really, really clear fairly early that the odds of you getting it when you're outside in an open space are really, really slim.
Yeah.
It became sort of like the left saying, no, everybody has to wear masks all the time. And the right saying, no, never. You sheeple, whatever, all these fights. And it's like, no, calm down. This is not politics. This is figuring out like what is the right choice and communicating about it, you know? Yeah.
And I know I'm probably the last person who should be bringing this up, or the last person that people thought would bring this up. But if you look at something like Lord of the Rings, here is a great example, right?
Yep, perfect.
All of these groups have very strong political opinions within those movies. The first three movies. I don't want to deal with The Hobbit yet, but the first three movies, it's very clear. The elves have a certain way that they look and process the world. The hobbits certainly like to be like Switzerland and stay out of all of it and don't want to get involved. And you've got the dwarves with their own points of views. And then you've got Sauron, right, who is the eye in the sky there that is the danger. He's the Thanos of the whole situation.
Right? When you said the eye in the sky, I was picturing him doing the traffic reports. It's like, this is Sauron, your eye in the sky.
We got a lot of
heavy traffic coming to Mordor.
The exit to the Shire is blocked off now. What you see is that they all come together in that council, and men, right? Men, they all come together in that council. And it's not like, okay, we're all kumbayaing around the table. No. Well, let's go. It's much more everyone expressing their points of views, their concern, their beliefs, what side of the fence they might be on this. Do they think these are the right people that have been chosen to carry out this task to destroy the ring, to confront Sauron? And so there is all these people come together from different points of views, agreeing by the end of that council about where to go. Do they all coincide? No, because Sean Bean obviously has his own point of view on the whole situation, and we see what happens to him. But we see that there are a coming together of different points of views, but they understand the general good is what needs to be served here. The overall good is what has to be at stake. And so they send them off to go and do this stuff. And it is an incredible journey. They overcome so much to try to make it happen, but in the end it does happen. And so that's really important to consider when you look at movies that teach you or show you what we can be in times of crisis, because essentially is a human movie, even with all the species, it's a human point of view. And so I think you appreciate those films even more when you see how divided we seem to be nowadays in retrospect, you know?
Well, and you think about, like, what is the fundamental conflict at the Council of Elrond is whether or not we can use this power.
Yes.
Like, do we use the power? And obviously Sean Bean's character wants to use the power. And the thing is, you can use the power, but power corrupts. And like, what's so great about the message of that movie is, first of all, it's the entire theme is the discipline to not use the evil power, which I'm going to relate to. Not use all the negative stuff that I've been railing against this whole conversation. It's like, yeah, you could use that power and you could get weaponize it against this other side, but it actually isn't going to do us any good in the long run. And the other thing about Lord of the Rings and why I'm so glad you brought it up is that it is the humblest characters that are the heroes.
Yeah.
It is the characters who don't want power, who aren't ambitious, who are simply there going, we have to do this because this is the right thing to do to save the world. That's what has to happen, regardless of the sacrifice. They're not going to get anything out of it. It's going to be nothing but pain and sacrifice and turmoil. And frankly, Frodo's a messed up person at the end of that story, you know, but that's what was necessary. It's what he was willing to endure that is. And these are the heroes that are out working in the hills in Los Angeles and in Altadena and Pacific Palisades right now. They're not doing it because they're going to get glory out of it or power out of it or anything else. They're out there risking their lives because it is the right thing to do. And that's it, you know?
Yeah. I think that's important because, you know, my sister worked in the fire department for years. Her husband is still very much connected to the fire department. They're on the East Coast. And so I've spoken to firefighters over the years. I've spoken and grew up with people who became firefighters. There's a calling to that life. That really is a unique calling, and what you and how you come to terms with that element of the world in terms of the fire is amazing. And the people who and they're willing to risk their lives, they're willing to risk their lives for strangers to go into their homes and try to save as much as possible from their homes or their offices or structures there to try to do what's right here to help people overcome sadness, try to stop it from spreading to other people so that they don't have to endure the kind of loss that people are who have endured that loss already are experiencing. So firefighters are a unique brand of human beings. And yes, you can say whatever you want of their issues with cops and all of that. But like, honestly, when the chips are down, they step up, they sacrifice, they spend hours. As I said, you know, some of these firefighters have been interviewed by some of these reporters and they've been saying that they are working 24 hours. Then they're not even getting fed regular meals. So they're even working on empty stomachs. They're working without maybe some energy in their bodies to help them work even harder, but they're still willing to put themselves out on the front line to stop this stuff from happening. There are prisoners who are working right now in with the fire department to try to stop this fire from spreading. So the incarcerated parts of our society, the banished parts of our society, are stepping up to help in a situation like this, you know? And so I think that deserves an incredible amount of credit. And I hope that gives us hope of what can be in the future again with this country of ours, because we are stronger together than we ever are apart. And just as we saw in the council there in the Lord of the Rings, neither one of those groups solo would have been able to accomplish what they all accomplished at the end by sending out these group of people.
There's I want to talk about some of the stuff you brought up, and then I have another movie to introduce to our conversation. But there's a quote from you. I've talked many times about the Patrick O'Brien books, the Aubrey Maturin novels, which I love. There's a quote from Stephen Maturin, which is something like, there are people who either believe it's that my country is always right, which is imbecile, or my country right or wrong, which is infamous. Which I think is a great quote. And I think what it leads to is this: we want to just be able to sum up, the police are either good or they're bad.
Yeah.
And it's like, instead of going like, there are things that happen within police departments that are problematic and should be addressed. Yeah. And it's not all cops are great guys. Some of them are not. And there are also the vast majority of people that show up every day to protect and serve are doing it for the right reasons. Not that they're perfect. And so just being like condemning, or, you know, we get in this weird place. We can't even have a conversation because you're either going cops are evil or you can't say anything bad about cops. And it's like, we can actually have a nuanced conversation, which leads me to the next movie that I want to bring up, which is one of your all time favorite films, which is 12 Angry Men.
Oh, yeah.
Is 12 Angry Men. Is it a story about coming together to solve a crisis? No, not exactly. But there are 12 people, very, very different. All with their own biases, all with their own perspectives, and they are all essentially going to work together to find justice, find the truth. And each one of them has to confront parts of themselves that maybe aren't so pretty, that they have to deal with their own issues in order to strip down their perspectives and strip down their biases in order to come to the truth. And that is, and in the end, it's about justice and what's right. And that's what I love that movie. You know,
that's a great point you bring up. Yeah, because the film itself is led again by someone who does not want to be in charge. He's not the foreman of the jury, juror number 8. He is someone who is just saying, wait, we need to really look at all this before we make these decisions and go in this direction. And all of these people have their own selfish desires for why they want to get out of that room, right? And it's, again, they are politicizing in their own minds the situation. And we see that, comes from a low rent housing situation, or he's a kid who's disrespectful to his dad. I know these people. Things of that nature are coursing throughout. There's a guy who wants to get to a ball game, right? There's a guy who he needs to have it presented to him in a certain way, logically, so that he can turn on it. And so we see step by step how, you're right, Steve, every one of these guys who don't initially side with Henry Fonda's character, juror number 8, they have to come to terms with their own stuff of what's clouding their judgment, what is impairing their objectivity as they look at this situation, because it is not yes, he's guilty, or no, he's not guilty. Is there a reasonable doubt? That's right. What they have to come to terms with. Is there a reasonable doubt? Well, it's tough to find that reasonable doubt if you bring your own biases, your own prejudices in to the situation. And this is where I think it becomes a difficult to do now to do the assessment of what went wrong here, because what you want to do is have an honest assessment. Okay, what actually went wrong here? What are the situations? How can we do better, right? But what I feel is going to happen, and what is already happening, is it's going to devolve into let's blame everybody, let's make everybody feel terrible, and then, you know, we've gotten rid of the people we want to get rid of. We'll put our people in, and if they make mistakes, then we'll just blame it on the other side anyway. So there's not this consistency of calling out. And that needs to be what also returns is a consistent calling out all sides of a situation here so that we all can come to terms with it, removing as much biases as possible and reach the right verdict in essence, or reach the right decision in essence, because by the end, that's what happens in 12 Angry Men. And that's one of the things that still inspires me about that film and about that play, is that it's not that he was right. It's that they had to notice that there was reasonable doubt here, and they had to look at it honestly, and they're made to look at it honestly, and it's beautiful. Right. There's another film I think I want to, oh God, can I, do I dare bring up Armageddon? Do I dare?
Dude, it's on my list, on my list too. If you hadn't brought it up, I would have. Go ahead.
You know, a legendary film in the history of the cinephiles, Armageddon. Steve and I did an episode of that very early, right? Maybe the second or first season of the show. We did our assessment of Armageddon as a fun lark. I remember sitting in my old apartment there in Hollywood by the Grove, and Steve and I recording the episode. And I just remember that film is a film that I go back to. Yes, there's fun, cheesy stuff, whatever, but it's actually really an inspiring film. And this is why I love it. And I joke about it being, you know, the greatest American film of the last 40 years and all of that. But it's really about the fact that these guys are blue collar dudes who are recruited into an impossible situation and asked to overcome insane odds in order to accomplish what they have to accomplish in to save the earth. And they're not going, well, we're going to save only the Democrats or only the Republicans or only the Trump lovers. They're trying to save the entire earth. And all of them are recruited to go and do this. And they all have certain assets and they all have certain flaws. They all get exposed in the process of coming together, but they're willing to do it. Each one of them is given a chance to say no, and all of them get on board to do this, risking their lives, and some of them do die in the process to save the earth. And just when it looks like it might not happen, you have one person, the leader, who steps forward, sacrificing themselves, pushing past what he's been told he can do and they can do in order to save the earth, and sacrificing himself in order to save the earth. So you can make fun of the movie all you want, and I respect the people who want to criticize it, but the message overall is about coming together from different walks of life, different points of views, different colors, different ethnicities, different genders, and different countries, even with Russia, with that, and solving the issue here as best you can by the end of the movie, so that everyone can benefit. So there is still a very powerful message of overcoming the odds when you come together as human beings to solve a crisis.
Structurally, it's the Avengers. You know, it's we're gonna gather this team, and we're gonna go, all of us risk our lives, and some, as you say, some lose their lives in order to save the world. Is it cheesy? Are there all sorts of things that don't make a lick of sense? Totally there are. But as I said, I know, you know, we had a fun disagreement on that show. Like Armageddon. I mean, Armageddon, for what it is, I will point out some things that make no sense, but that doesn't mean it's not a really, really fun movie. I want to just point out there's a whole genre of films that I would say, one that we did on the podcast is Stand and Deliver, which is the school version of this, which is you have this ragtag bunch of students and an inspiring teacher, and that inspiring teacher helps them to come together and do something that they couldn't all do. Stand and Deliver is a perfect example. There's also, which is totally, we're about to do Dragnet as a watch along. Yeah. Yeah. This is a guilty pleasure that I would watch in the same way. And that is Summer School with Mark Harmon, directed by Carl Reiner. It's exactly Stand and Deliver, but it's more ridiculous, just as Armageddon is Apollo 13, but more ridiculous. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, and then there's things like Mr. Holland's Opus, but this is a whole like genre of films where we have the inspiring teacher and the class comes together. A bunch of people that wouldn't like each other or get along necessarily work together to accomplish something great.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's important. And even if you look at, we've done this film multiple times on the Cinephiles, look at Die Hard. Right. Totally. Here's a situation where there's a person caught. Yeah, it happens to be another Bruce Willis movie, but there's a person caught in an impossible situation, a situation that didn't anticipate. Right. And there could be people on the ground and be like, well, what was the security like? How were terrorists able to get into the building here? Clearly, there were DEI guards and DEI, all of that nonsense. It's an Asian owned business, Japanese, not American. You know, like, why are we sacrificing American police to save a Japanese company? There's none of that in the film. But, you know, nowadays, if this really happened, there would be articles upon articles on all these websites and all these bloggers and all these podcast hosts and whatever who are invested in fanning the flames of division in order to line their pockets with money, who would absolutely create those narratives. You know, how did the American government allow these terrorists to, did they come through the border? Like, you could absolutely take that movie and break it down that way. But instead, the movie is about a dude who is trying to repair his marriage, gets caught in an insane situation that nobody could have planned for, and has to communicate with the character of Reginald Vell Johnson plays there on the ground. So a black man and a white man can come together to help them overcome these terrorists who are trying to be thieves in essence and have a false narrative that they pump out about wanting to free all these freedom fighters across the world, when in fact all they're doing is trying to make money using a false narrative. So there's a lot within that movie about coming together in a time of crisis to overcome this stuff and fight through this stuff, which I think is incredible when you look at it in a very micro way.
Well, and it also is a perfect example of not coming together, because it also has the police chief or Dwayne, the assistant deputy chief, Dwayne Robinson, who's all about himself. And he's all about his ego and how things reflect upon him or don't reflect upon him, rather than just what is the problem and how do we solve it? Like, John McClane doesn't go, I mean, inside he's probably going, why me? And why did this happen to me and all that stuff? But what he's doing is going, I have to deal with what's the reality, which is that there's these terrorists and I have to protect these people. That's it. Yeah. That's what he has to do. Like, I think I want practical things to come before the narrative for a while. Mm. Like, I know it's not realistic. I know it's not going to happen. It's certainly not the way the incoming administration operates. Because the thing is like, if again, I'm going to try to walk the line of staying in the middle about this. But I think if we had actually had a discussion about the border and immigration, dealing with all the problems around it, we would see that there's actually truth on both sides. Is it hard on border towns that are flooded with immigrants that are undocumented coming into the city? Yeah, that's hard on them. That's not made up. That's a real thing. Yeah. But because we put it on this standard of good versus evil, we can't have that conversation, because it's only either you're a racist or you're trying to smuggle people in for, you know, create voters or whatever these narratives are that are somewhat ridiculous. Like, that's what it becomes. I'm trying to pick I know what my next movie I'm going to pick,
okay,
which is a film. I don't know if you've seen this one. King Vidor, 1934, Our Daily Bread.
No, I've never seen this. Please.
This is a movie I stumbled across years and years. It was at the time where I realized I could program my TiVo. So that shows how old this was, to just record directors. So I just said, okay, John Huston, King Vidor, Fritz Lang. I listed a whole bunch of directors. This movie came up. It is a Depression era movie. And it is like, there's this young city couple and they lose everything in the Depression and they ended up inheriting a piece of land in the country. So they're like, well, I guess we'll go be farmers, but they have no idea how to be farmers. So they're totally failing. And then other people fleeing the Depression start showing up at this location where they are. And they essentially go, oh, well, you know how to farm. I know how to cut hair. Well, I'm good at managing money. I know how to cook. And they essentially create a natural commune. Wow. It's all of these people who are all lost and all had nowhere to go. And they realize that by working together and sharing all their skills, they can build, and one of them is a teacher. So she ends up being the teacher for the kids because everyone can't watch their own kids because they're out all working on the farm. And another person's an engineer and they're the one who figures out how to bring the water and all that stuff. And then, of course, what happens is the local town decides they have to shut this down because it's being too successful and it's working too well. And is this a movie that you could totally, you know, I'm sure Red Scare a decade later starts to go like, hey, this sounds like a bunch of communism. And you know what? Yeah, probably is. But it is a really good movie about just ordinary people realizing that they could, if they can depend upon each other and build this life together that's supportive and wonderful. It's a really good film.
Yeah, and I think this is just because I haven't seen it, but just talking about it from what you presented, what happens here in the moment? A town is politically threatened by what this commune is doing. It fabricates narratives in order to inspire people to push against it. And the people don't question these narratives because that town has probably taken care of them for years, or they've grown up in that town. And so they just go along with it to go after this commune because it's been vilified. It's been created in their minds as something negative, and they all come together. And that's, I guess, another side of the crisis conversation, Steve, is there are times where in these movies, people are tricked into coming together in order to destroy an evil that isn't evil, right? And that's the thing that you see sometimes too, where we see people who subscribe to false narratives in order to destroy something that was good, but they can't have it be a part of their world anymore because it threatens their money, it threatens their existence, it threatens their ability to stay in power in the area that they're in.
You know, it just occurred to me, and it's just, I don't want to make a long digression of it, but like a movie that is about someone using a false narrative in order to bring a community together and basically make money off of them.
Yeah,
is a movie that has trouble with a capital T, which rhymes with P, and that stands for pool, is the music. That's what the music band is.
Yes.
He comes in and says, hey, there's this threat to your young people, and you need to make a boys band in order to stop it. And of course, really, he's just there to make a lot of money to take advantage of their fear, which he creates.
Yeah. And so we see this happen. And I want to get to one of the things that someone brought up here. This is an interesting conversation. Vince is one. We're going to answer your super chats rather than come through. And the Streamlabs super chats both open to send in here as we get into the last half an hour of the show. Vincent Zawada says another example is John Carpenter's The Thing. And that is a great example, right? Because another thing that I think we have to be aware of when it comes to crisis movies is sometimes they're also class warfare movies, right? I mean, even to go back to Die Hard, you could argue that there's a sense that these are blue collar guys, right? Bruce Willis is just a cop. Totally. He's a cop. Reginald L. Johnson, it's a black and white cop, right? What they call a black and white. But you get Dwayne, who comes in, who's been sitting in an office the whole time. And rather than taking the advice or the analysis of the guy on the ground, he's going to go through his book of what he's supposed to do, checking off the boxes. And he isn't doing it from a place of fear. He's doing it from a place of arrogance. Then Johnson and Johnson show up from this FBI or CIA, and they're just as incompetent and arrogant and stupid. And things happen to both of them. Dwayne gets buttfucked, and they get blown up by a helicopter. A buttfuck on national TV is figuratively. And they get blown up on a helicopter there off the roof because they wouldn't listen to the guys on the ground. There's that sense of arrogance and wealth and class and what have you. In the Parasite is another example that which we'll get to, but Carpenter's a Thing is a great point because there is a hierarchy in that base of who should be listened to, who should not be listened to. And McMurtry, I think his name is it McMurphy? I think it's McMurphy. He's not the lead of the movie initially. He becomes the lead as the film goes along, but he's not the top guy at that center, at that facility. But we see all these guys come together step by step, piece by piece, remove the hierarchy because the overall thing is what they've got to stop. And they come together to do that eventually.
Well, the thing I love about the example of The Thing is, you know, we've been talking this whole time about people wanting to use the disaster to manufacture a narrative that casts someone as good guys and bad guys. Like that's this thing we've seen all the time. Well, and it makes it really, really hard to trust the other side when you've been labeling them as evil this whole time. It's really hard to work with them. Well, what is The Thing about? In The Thing, there is an absolutely clear reason why you can't actually trust all the people that you're with. Yeah. And yet in order to succeed, they have to overcome that distrust that's very real and grounded in an alien that's going to kill them all in order to survive. And so like this is that you actually have to, it's not just that you have to overcome fake conflicts, Yeah. You actually have to overcome real conflicts. Like, I, you know, we were talking about Carter and some of the politics over time, yeah, and how where we've ended up. But like Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan, they made deals together.
Yes.
Does that mean they agreed? No, they were on opposite sides politically, but they knew that in order to run a country that they had to get in the office together and work out deals. And that, and they did. And we're not capable of that right now. You know,
we don't seem to be. You're right. And I think you mentioned Alien, and it got me going down a whole path mentally, right? And Alien is an interesting example too, because you have a android in Ash that basically pumps out a false narrative himself and allows a thing to come in that destroys almost the entire crew of the ship, and could have possibly destroyed everything on Earth if it had landed on Earth. But they have a ulterior motive and a false narrative to push, and these guys violate the rules. Sigourney Weaver is the character. Ripley is the one saying, "No, no, we cannot let him in for 24 hours. We got to test him." No, 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 it's our buddy. Once again, it's this idea of, well, it's close to me. I know it. So therefore, the rules shouldn't apply to someone I know. But the rules are set up exactly to avoid what happens in Alien. And it's because people ignore what could be the false narrative coming in, that the false narrative comes in, corrupts, and kills everybody on the ship except for Ripley. So it's I guess Ripley kills Ash, so it doesn't kill the alien. But like, you see that situation there in that movie. If they had adhered to the rules, adhered to what was going on, then they wouldn't have had the negative situation happen. But someone with an ulterior motive causes the problem, you know?
It's so funny when you were talking about, well, he's our buddy, and so we have to bend the rules. And Buddy immediately became Bucky in my mind. And I went back to Captain America Civil War, because that's what happens in that. Well, and let's take it forward to Aliens.
Yeah.
Because in Aliens, again, you have this corporate structure that isn't listening to the boots on the ground.
Yes.
And then you have Sigourney Weaver, you have Ripley, who understands what's going on. And then eventually, like, again, it's the difference between the person that can spit out a narrative that's a charismatic leader in one way or another, and someone who actually knows what the fuck they're doing. And I actually really like people who know what the fuck they're doing. Like, people talking about firefighting who've never fought a fire. It's like, no, I want to hear the people who fight the fire. And it's like, If I can say anything just to dispel any narratives about the LA fires, there is some evidence that maybe some of them started with arson and maybe not. We really don't know anything yet. We really don't. And so I don't want to put out any of those things. But the big thing that people don't understand is it was 80 miles an hour winds, and it was, you know, growth, and it was dry. And that is why these fires were so big. It wasn't because of any conspiracy or anything else. It was because of those things, and that is what the firefighters are saying.
You know? Yeah, and we're also seeing connected to, and this is a great point you bring up, Steve. Of course, that's, you have to look at it, and this is what we said. Like, go back and look at after this is contained and settled and taken care of, go back and honestly assess what happens, and also create what happened, and also create grace for, like, no one would have done a better job in a situation. No one could have done seen what was coming. No one. So you just have to create the context from which to understand the mistakes that were made, but also create grace for the situation as it came about, as an impossible or crazy situation that nobody could have prepared for or acted and did every right thing possible to minimize the damage. It was so impossible to be on top of this kind of stuff. Yeah. So I think it's important. But what we also see popping up amidst the criticism of what's going on here, and I think it's important to connect it to the movies as well, is there's a class warfare aspect to this, right? Because you're seeing a lot of people coming out and bashing celebrities and not caring that they're losing their homes. And that's a class frustration being expressed. Oh, it's rich people. Who cares? It's these actors. Who cares? It's the Hollywood elite. Who cares? Again, dehumanizing these people, dehumanizing the fact that they have worked hard to achieve the things that they've achieved. Yeah, so have some of them nepo babies or had things handed them? Fine. But most of them have worked hard to achieve success in a town that is very difficult to achieve success in. Oh, and by the way, you own probably a lot of the movies that these people have been in, or the TV shows, or what have you. But now when a fire happens, you want to turn on them and laugh at them as they're experiencing the pain that they're experiencing. And that thing, that's coming from a place of class warfare. And that's where I think Parasite is a good example of that as well when it comes to that situation, right? You see the class warfare within that's operating on three different levels, right? With the initial family who comes together to go after the rich family and trick them and what have you. But then the maid's family with her and her husband and what happens with that. So there is this sense of the class warfare aspect of it all. It leads to dehumanization of the other side, but it also dehumanizes you because you're the person that's saying that they are somehow of less value human-wise than you because of money or what have you. And I think that is a negative thing we have to kind of come to terms with as well, you know? Or am I off base? I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I don't think that Parasite quite falls into the Apollo 13 category of people working together to not solve a common cause.
Yeah, no,
but I definitely agree with you in terms of like a narrative about what people are,
yes,
you know, and how difficult it is for us to see past our narrative. So like the wealthy family can't have really any conception of what life is like for this poor family.
Yeah.
Like they can't, you know, and how trapped they are and all the things that they struggle with. But then the dehumanization of the wealthy family is like, no, no, they're humans too. Like people tend to go like, oh, well, you have money, you have these things that I want, money or fame.
Right.
And therefore you must not have any other problems. And, you know, it's like, I know I mentioned to you that I'm heading up to the Bay Area because my mom is receiving an award, the Essie Award for all of her work with the ALS Network, which is wonderful. That's happening this weekend. And it's like, well, my family had some money and some resources, and my dad died of ALS. And my dad dying of ALS was no less shitty because we had money or resources. It's still a terrible disease. Did the money and did family and friends and things like that help us to navigate it maybe more easily than someone who didn't have those resources? Absolutely. Of course, it absolutely did. But that doesn't mean that the pain of my father's death is less. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, this is why I say it's like, Billy Crystal lost his house. That's really, really shitty. That's fucking sucks, man. And so like the lack of human, like just, again, it goes back to these narratives is if you dole out your human compassion based on where someone fits in some narrative you've created of good guys and bad guys, then you got to look at that narrative because that's not how humans are. That's not how we work. Yeah. I got arguably the greatest movie I could possibly add to this list.
Okay.
And that is The Seven Samurai.
Yes.
Seven Samurai. I don't think any movie I can think of handles more breadth of people facing a crisis at every single level with every single different motivation, whether they are scared or greedy or only want to look out for themselves or really, really want to show themselves as a hero, like the young kid, or, you know, each of their different protect the daughter or protect the village or vengeance for the loss of the wife or all of these reasons and all of the fear and people that don't want to participate and don't want to be a part of it and watching them come together as a group, in particular, the moment where Toshirô Mifune brings out the banner and puts it on the top in the beautiful wind. And then the moment where, you know, they're trying to force the families that live outside the walls to come inside. And Takashi Shimura literally is like, if you don't have a choice anymore, I'm going to kill you if you don't join, because that's what this means at this moment. It is the entire journey of what it requires to take on something as big as what they are taking on, and the sacrifice and the work and the fear and the entire human experience, I think, is in Seven Samurai.
That's a great point, because some people don't want to work, right? Some people don't. Some people want to lay down to these bandits and give up their stuff and like say like, well, if we do it, then maybe they'll leave us alone or it won't be so bad. But there's other people want to fight because they don't want to be subject to this nonsense anymore. They want to destroy this entity once and for all. And the irony of the movie, which I think is very brilliant, is that you find out that these bandits are just as desperate as these farmers because they need to eat, and they have assigned or they have accepted this way of life as a bandit. And so it comes with, it's feast or famine as a bandit. And so they also, in a weird way, there's a sense of like, well, you understand their desperation, even though they're terrifying these towns. they're trying to eat. They're trying just to stay alive themselves. So it becomes a really interesting situation when you look at it. But yes, all these people come together from different walks of life, different classes yep. of existence there in the hierarchy of that town, in order to, in the end, stop this these group of people from taking most of everything they have constantly, all the time. Yeah,
and they need all of them. That's the other. Yeah. It's like they didn't think at the beginning that they needed Tashir Mifune. Like he's kind of a fool and kind of, you know, all the things that are. But in the end, he's central to bringing everybody together. Every one of those people, despite what we might think about at the beginning, becomes necessary because that's what's necessary, is everybody coming together to save the village. You know,
yeah, great points, Steve. Great. Well, let's get into these super chats here as we're winding down the show here. Let's read some of these. This Philip Bryan says, "Afternoon, gents. What's up, Philip? Good to see you. I've got family coming over, so I'll catch your answer when I watch later. But here's my question: what are a couple of comfort films that you like to watch during a time of personal crisis?" Wow, great question, Steve. Do you have some answers to this question?
Well, it's funny. It came up in our advisory board meeting a couple of days ago, but I had just watched Twins with my son.
Oh, and
it was so great. It was so much fun. It was so funny. He thought it looked pretty cheesy when it started. He's like, this movie is silly. And then there was this moment where he clicked in, and he being with my son, watching him appreciate this goofy movie with me was just great. Another one, by the way, that pops in my mind, which kind of fits into this category for me as well, is Frank Capra's You Can't Take It With You. It's just movie that just makes me smile. It makes me happy. It's fun, and it is definitely about the spirit of working together in community rather than making money and, you know, destroying the enemy. How about you?
I think for me it's always Wrath of Khan. It's always Wrath of Khan.
So yeah, totally.
If I'm in a personal crisis, I'm in a place where I'm really like feeling down about myself, or, you know, going into the mental health places, Khan is an essential film for me because of my love for Kirk, my love of Shatner, but also this is a film that shows you a vulnerable person who you had revered as a hero who had all the answers coming out of the original series. And here is an enemy from his past who comes in, and as he says in the film, catches him with his pants down because he thinks he's got the answers. He thinks he can navigate a situation here, but this is something where he has to really confront himself and overcome things, right? And come to terms with the fact that he is meant to be a captain, not an admiral, not these other things that he could have stubbornly tried to not captain the ship. As Spock tells him in the film, you know, what does he say? Like you're assuming something about the situation. You assume I have some ego or pride that there is to bruise, but there is no ego to bruise here. Your first and best destiny is captain of the ship. And so you see him come to terms with that, but he has to overcome all these things in order to achieve the success. And in the end loses his best friend. Yes. Does he come back and all of that? Yes. But if the film is taken as a singular film, he loses his best friend in the process, who makes the ultimate sacrifice for everyone on the ship to save them. And he is arguably, supposedly, the least human of everybody on the ship. And that's what is so amazing to watch in that film. And so I always come out of that film inspired. I always come out of that film like, hey, it's not as bad as you think. And look what happened with him. And yes, it's a fake story. It's a fake character, whatever. But there's something that feels real, feels humanly real to me when I watch that movie that helps to kind of center me a little bit, you know.
Couldn't agree more about Wrath of Khan. Yeah. And I'll say, I have my buddy Adam Colite, who you met years and years and years ago, who I went to film school with. But what I always said, like, when we would play movie after movie, you and Steve Jones were both better than me. Like, it was sort of like I was a good college player, and you and Steve Jones were pros, were NFL players, who could generally beat me, although I could get in there sometimes.
You can.
And then Adam Colite was in the Pro Bowl. Like, Adam Colite was so far, he would wipe all of us out. And he, because he would bring in, like, you know, actors from the French New Wave and all these people. Yeah. But he said, at one point we're having dinner, I said something about Wrath of Khan, and he said, "Oh, greatest film of the 80s. And I thought he was joking because he's such an intellectual. And I was like, are you kidding? And he went, "No. The Wrath of Khan is the greatest film of the 80s.
Wow.
Yeah.
I have to sit with that. I am going to have to sit with that. I like that, but I'm going to have to sit with that because there were some damn good films in the 80s, bro.
Damn good films.
I mean,
but Wrath of Khan is, it's almost perfect from beginning to end.
I agree.
I mean, it's so good.
Thank you, Philip, for that question. Darren Wright, and let us know what yours are, Philip, later on if you want. Darren Wright says, hey, Cinephile. Oh, Happy New Year, Cinephiles. What's up, Darren? Thanks for all the shows in 2024 and before you've given and before you've given and for all the films I'm still yet to see on my list I found because of the show. Well, thank you, Darren. You know, I love you madly, brother, and I appreciate you sending stuff in. I hope you're doing well there in England, and things are looking up for you in 2025. So I appreciate you sending the stuff in. Steve, I'm sure you do as well. It's always nice.
Absolutely. It's always good to hear from Darren. I really, really do appreciate it.
Yeah. Al Black just sends us a little bit of support. Thank you, Al. Appreciate
Thank you,
it.
Al.
Vincent Zawada says, recent film for an example is Godzilla Minus One. I had that on the list. I even put it in our thumbnail as something to discuss. I went and found that picture and put it up there. Yeah, everything in the thumbnail that you see for this show are all films that I thought matched what we were talking about. And I covered up other films that were in that original picture so that I could put the films that I thought matched up with what the theme of the show was. Godzilla Minus One was definitely one of those. You saw that one, right, Steve? So what do you, have you seen this one yet?
Loved it. And it absolutely 100% fits this category. This is exactly what it is.
Yeah.
Is, and again, it's also, you know, particularly the main character, a troubled, messed up guy who has a lot to overcome in order to do what's right and, again, save the world. Like, yeah, absolutely, this is an example of that.
I think there's a really great connection to mention Godzilla Minus One. Thank you, Vincent. You're absolutely right, because we see what Godzilla does, which is lay waste to that town randomly as essentially a natural disaster, because there is no kind of, I'm going to find somebody in this town and kill them. He's just laying waste to that town randomly and then walking back into the ocean. Well, how do we stop that fire from coming back to destroy the town again? Is that we all come together using all of our expertise. And yes, we question things. We're not sure if we should do it. We're not sure if we'll be successful at it, but we're all going to come together. And it hinges on a guy who has PTSD from the war,
right,
who, by the way, lost the war. Right. So there's all of that that's mixed into this, but they all come together from different classes, different intelligence levels, and with different duties and different jobs, accomplish the goal at the end, or so we think, because the eye still opens. But like, it's a great ending overall, showing you how people come together in times of crisis to fight back against this thing. So, yeah, good point. Thank you, Vincent. Wayne is in here. Wayne, what's up, Wayne Edwards? He says, thanks for the live show, guys. The three movies that come to mind that have some type of crisis or tragedy and the characters attempt to overcome it are The Poseidon Adventure, The Towering Inferno, and Deep Impact. Yeah, Steve, your thoughts on these three examples from Wayne here?
Absolutely. I think when we were first talking about this, Towering Inferno and Poseidon Adventure came up right away. Yes, these are absolutely. Well, this is what it is you, here is the disaster. You put an ensemble of people in the disaster, and they all have to find their way through it. That is classic structure. I haven't seen The Poseidon Adventure as an adult. So I know it's one. Yes, I know. I know it's one of your favorites. I definitely saw it like in high school.
Yeah.
I don't think I saw it since college. Towering Inferno, I watched a ton. I think you watched Poseidon Adventure more than Towering Inferno, right?
Yeah. Well, yes, but only because Poseidon was the one that was constantly on TBS or TNT. If Towering had been on TBS and TNT at the frequency that Poseidon was, I would have seen that more. I would have seen that just as much. But yes, Poseidon Adventure, great. The original, don't mess with that Poseidon nonsense. That remake was terrible. The Poseidon Adventure, which is one that is just absolutely correct. A random thing happens, like a wave hitting this ship, turning it upside down. And what you have is people separating out into their separate groups, thinking they know the right answer. And instead of listening to the guy who is figuring it out step by step, they go their own direction. They believe someone else. They believe someone else's narrative or false point of view. And it leads to most of them dying. And even the ones that survive, or even the ones that are right, some of them die, including the leader, in the process of achieving the ultimate goal was, which is to get out of this situation and survive. So yeah, The Poseidon Adventure is a great film with great acting and some truly sad moments. Towering Inferno is fun because Towering Inferno also throws in a little bit of the class warfare situation, right, with Richard Chamberlain's character, which is a lot of fun throughout. And of course, you've got McQueen and Newman both in that. Deep Impact, I hear you. I don't know if I 100% am on board with that, but I get it, you know, because you are having people come together to fight off this meteor that's coming. But
I think structurally it is exactly that. Yeah. I don't remember. I mean, I saw it in the theater when it came out. I didn't particularly like it at the time. I have almost no memory of it today. So,
You know, except for Morgan Freeman, of course, as the president, which is great.
Sure.
But thank you, Wayne. Those are great suggestions. Wayne also says, I'm also disturbed by this dehumanization of those who lost their homes by some in the general public. Where did this come from? By the way, Failsafe is another film that I watch in times of crisis. Oh, that's a great choice. See, yeah.
I don't know, man. I can't watch Failsafe in the middle of a crisis. I don't want to escape the crisis by just going into the world's worst crisis. That seems difficult.
It's a good question. He asks, where did this come from, this dehumanization, Steve? I mean, I have my thoughts on it. What do you think?
I mean, I think, you know, we talked about this process that began the destruction of the American mythos going back to the Kennedy assassination and moving forward.
Yeah.
I think that's a piece of it. But then the other piece is just social media and the speed of which, you know, like, it's like everything becomes a Rorschach test where you go, okay, you see a person, you know, like there was the New Orleans guy who, you know, drove his car through everybody and he'd left boxes and they saw people looking at the boxes and people went, oh, well, those must be his accomplices, which they weren't, you know, but it's like you see an image and then you just immediately put that narrative on the image. And then that spreads like wildfire through the internets. And suddenly people have it's not just people lost their houses, but why did the people lose their houses and who are they and why did they deserve it or not deserve it? And that's where this is all coming from, as opposed to you should feel shitty for anybody that lost their house. That should be it. That should be the end.
I think the and those are great points, Steve. Totally agree with all of them. I also think the dehumanization is always attached to a divide that becomes almost untenable between the haves and the have-nots. I think that's where it becomes a really important thing from both sides, by the way, right? Because the rich go, well, you're poor because you choose to be poor. You didn't do the things I did. You didn't sacrifice like I did. You didn't follow the path like I did. So you deserve your terrible life. And why should I pay tax dollars to help your life and existence? So they're dehumanizing them from above, right? You are like Harry Lime in The Third Man. You're ants to me. You're not actually human beings. Yet they'll go to church and talk about God's love of everybody, God's creatures and all that. And on the other side, there is a hatred that develops amongst people who have lower financial situation or station towards those with money. And we see that in High and Low. Of course, Kurosawa's High and Low is a great example of that. In his mind, the kid sees the house on the hill and has developed a hatred to whoever lives in that house on the hill. Because in his mind, he has created a narrative of this being a fat cat who cares nothing for the people below. When in fact, it's a guy who has worked really hard, built his family business into a big corporation. And now, because of what this kid does, he is almost going to tear the whole thing down, all because he stole the wrong child, right? And so you have that as an element of it. So I think class warfare, dehumanization has its foundation in class warfare in terms of financial status. And I think that's where a lot of it comes from, you know, in my opinion.
I think that's a big piece of it. I think our ability to divide ourselves up into groups, whether they're groups by political party, by class, by race, by gender, by whatever, and then to label that group and think that we understand it. And it's like, and I'll throw out just another movie quickly, which sort of fits this, but it definitely fits what we're talking about, which is The Breakfast Club.
Oh, yeah.
Which is here's a film where everybody has their image of who that person is and what it means to be that kind of person. And they have all their judgments locked in. And it's not that their judgments are entirely wrong. Right. It's not that they know nothing about, you know, like, is Claire a little bit arrogant and thinks she's better than some of the other people?
Yeah.
Yeah. Does Anthony Michael Hall's character think he's smarter than everybody else? Yeah, he does. Does Bender have all sorts of judgments about everybody? Yeah. They all have judgments. And, yeah, and a lot of those things might be true, but it's putting them in the room together. It's like 12 yeah. Angry Men, where it forces them to actually see each other as humans and understand each other. And that's what breaks through all that. So that's where I go, like, if the problem is we're all in our silos creating judgments about all these other people and what it means to be in this group or this group or this group or this group, yeah, the solution is to get out of those silos and actually meet those people and have conversations. And that's the thing about yeah. horrible tragedies like this yeah. is they should, with good leadership, they actually should make that happen, you know,
yeah,
is that you need Ed Harris to go, hey, everybody, let's come together and solve these problems. At the end of that, yeah, you have fewer judgments about those other people because you've worked and met with them and busted your ass to save people's lives.
Yeah.
You know,
great point, Steve. Absolutely great point. For sure. Let's see what else have we got here for people who are sending in stuff in. Let's see where we at here. Darren, you did something. Oh, says Darren says, doing great. Thanks, John and Steve. Never happier. New job and house last year. Celebrating my birthday today with your live show.
Happy birthday, Darren.
Happy birthday, Darren. Darren, starting my aim for 300 movie watches again this year. Man, God love you.
You'll beat me by about by like 240.
You might beat us combined, Darren. That's yeah. for sure. Thank you. We're really happy for you, brother. Love you. Really happy for you. Badass Time says 30 years too long. I'd give anything to see Val Kilmer's Chris somehow reconnect with Ashley Judge. Their connection was so real. Can Austin Butler do it justice? Can Michael Mann do it justice? So I guess he's asking about Heat too. So taking us on a bit of a tangent here, but he has paid for us to answer the question. So Steve, your thoughts, 30 years too long is to do a Heat 2 follow-up here. I mean, Val Kilmer has the throat cancer,
serious health problems. And,
yeah.
Well, I mean, I'll defer more to you because Heat is totally more your movie. I totally appreciate that movie. Yeah. I like the movie, but it's not one I go back to over and over again. I don't know what's there to do. I don't think you can bring Val Kilmer back. De Niro's dead. Okay. Right. Al Pacino's going to come back. And then, like, almost everybody else in the movie's dead. Like, what are you going to do?
I mean, I watched it again a week or two ago on one of the channels here. And that is such a young Pacino compared to Pacino now. That is such yeah. a young De Niro, you know. That's like right at the apex when they're about to go on the other side right. there in 1995. And so I don't know how you create that magic with the actors of today. There was something about De Niro and Pacino coming together in that movie that I don't think you can replicate with any actor, any pair of actors today that rival that situation. You can't, what are you going to have? DiCaprio and Chalamet or Austin Butler and Adam Driver? It's not quite the same magic as Pacino and De Niro. We don't have that in the crop of actors today. There are people who are damn good actors who are up and coming and who are established rather right now, but Pacino, De Niro, I don't think we have that. So I think it'd be tough to do it because the Heat to the book is a prequel and a sequel. So it goes back and forth, kind of like Godfather Part Two. So I guess you could do something like that, but you'd have to, I don't know, you'd have to present the sequel in a way that makes sense and bring in new characters. So I think it'd be very difficult to do. And I do think Ashley Judd's still alive. So in terms of the character, she's actually obviously still alive as a person. So you could bring her back, which could be
interesting. I mean, like I have not actually seen this, but I wouldn't have thought anyone would bother to, or there was any reason to make a sequel to Gladiator, being that the main characters are all dead.
Yes.
But they managed to do that. And so it's like, is Michael Mann a director capable of making a crime thriller possibly set in Los Angeles with yeah. a bunch of young actors that might be great? Sure. Does that make it Heat 2? I don't really know, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, because Gladiator 2 did not turn out well, in my opinion. Justin Toner says, hey, guys, what's up, Justin? From growing up, I remember disaster movies that fit the bill, like Earthquake, Airport, Towering Inferno. Also have to agree, Godzilla Minus One is a great, more recent example of that. Yeah, yeah, I remember Earthquake and Airport. What about you, Steve? Because isn't that Heston, well, Earthquake?
I don't remember. I know I saw it. I definitely know I saw it. Well, and we don't get airplane without airport.
Oh, 100%. 100%.
I mean, that's a disaster movie where a team has to come together to save the day.
Yes. And I guess airplane does work, right? Yeah. With Earthquake, it was Charlton Heston and Ava Gardner. Wow, what a twosome. Nice. For that one. I got to see that one again. Alan Smithy says, hi, John and Steve. I'm in your Patreon, but always working when the council meetings happen, so I'll just say hi here. Thank you, Smithy. Hello. Also, Jaws is similar to the LA firestorm situation. Thanks. Jaws?
I mean, I don't see it as similar to the LA fire. I mean, certainly what we do have is three people from very, very different backgrounds who have to come together to save the day in the second half of the film. That is definitely what it is. Like, can we say, I mean, like, maybe the narrative that Alan is heading towards is issues with the government that led to the fire, but I just don't think we're there yet, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's like people saying, like, why was Karen Bass in Africa? You know, and it's like, yeah, because she was in Africa. Like, no one, she didn't know, if she had known there was going to be a horrible fire, she probably wouldn't have scheduled the trip. But the fire wasn't scheduled, you know, like people travel. This is where these conspiracy theories just seem somewhat ridiculous to me, you know?
Yeah, and it becomes a situation where I can't take you seriously if you say dumb shit like that. And that poisons the narrative because you're trying to get to the answers and you can't get to the answers by creating false narratives. It's so frustrating, you know? And yeah. I think Jaws works in terms of, three different, but, and you could also throw in that there is a character with an ulterior motive, and that is Quint, who wants to kill this shark because he's got this Indianapolis stuff that he hasn't come to terms with. And so when he smashes the radio, when they could have called in help or could have come back into port, there is a sense that he always had this belief that this was kill or be killed. And these two guys were along for the ride. So they're collateral damage in it all, you know? So I think you could make a case, Smithy, for sure. Jad Lawend. Thank you, Jad. Says, Steve, I'm relieved that you and your family are safe. Okay, for me, my movies that bring me peace in a time of crisis is The Wizard of Oz, Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein, and Lord of the Rings trilogy. We did touch on Lord of the Rings. What about these other three?
I think those are great choices. I also think two of those are movies that we were just discussing as maybe this is the year that they might happen on the Cinephiles. Don't know that that's going to happen, yeah, but it's definitely true. We were talking about both The Wizard of Oz and Blazing Saddles as ones we would like to tackle. So I think they're great choices.
Those are great choices. It doesn't mean that they're overcoming any like big crisis. Well, I guess maybe because in Wizard of Oz, it's the witch, but it's not like she wanted to confront the witch, right? But then again, I mean, yeah, it was something that was put upon her like a fire would be. So yeah, I guess maybe you could make a case as I'm talking it out right now. You could make a case for Wizard of Oz. Could you make a case for Young Frankenstein or Blazing Saddles? I don't know, but certainly for
Blazing Saddles is 100% this. I hadn't thought about it until you just said it, but they literally have to build a fake town. The whole town has to come together to redirect the bad guys into the fake town, and they have to overcome racism and adversity and hating the sheriff and coming to like the sheriff, not to mention the fact that they had to get through a lot of Schnitzelgruben, because I think 14 is my limit on Schnitzelgruben in order to, I mean, like, there's a lot of stuff that has to happen in Blazing Saddles
and Mongo. That's right,
you gotta deal with Mongo.
Come on, man. And where are the white women at? So we'll see about that one down the road. You know what? Smithy follows up and says, what does he say here? I wanted to make sure to give him some love. He says, oh yeah, but the mayor isn't to blame in Jaws either. So is the mayor should have closed the beaches though. So I think he's a little bit to blame, right?
But based on the narrative that is in the film, which has nothing to do with shark science at all, I just had to point out, the mayor is 100% totally to blame, but it's also like, that argument in Jaws is a classic. We can't do this because we need to support the businesses. Business needs us to not.
Right.
You know, that's it. It is a narrative we're dealing with all the time in our world of like, do you protect the people or do you protect the business? That's something that goes on all the time.
Great point. Julius Wyatt, our last one, I think, as we wrap up, he says, hey, John, how are you feeling going into the game? He can tell I'm wearing a Commander's jersey. Our game is in about 30 minutes. I'm nervous, but we're also playing with house money because no one expected us to be in this position, and we have a rookie quarterback. So I just hope we acquit ourselves well, and if we win, that's great. But if we don't, as long as we play a good game, that's really all I care about at this point, is what I would say.
Wow, Outlaw is so easygoing at this. I'm just well, like,
right now I am
so calm.
Catch me in about an hour, maybe I will be. Hoth security guard says, going through some annoying stuff on the East Coast for me personally. Oh, sorry, buddy. Nothing compared to LA though, but I just want you both to know I appreciate every podcast and video and getting me through tonight with some takeout while I can really, well, I can finally relax a bit, and I'm sending love to you guys. Oh,
thank you so much. And I'm glad, I'm sorry to hear about the stuff you might be going through. And I'm glad to hear that the Cinephiles is helping out.
Yeah. Thanks for letting us help you out through this process. Cause you could, as people say, that you could pick it. There's 100 other podcasts you could pick. So we appreciate you that you are a faithful listener to us and that we help you through tough times. It's our pleasure. Yeah. It's our honor. Wiley, what's up, Wiley? Another one. He said, Wiley says, these fires have been awful and sickening. I feel terrible for everyone. I was wondering what movies you guys have turned to when you're having a hard time. Personally, at 24, I'm having a hard time, so I turn to movies and music. The Color of Money is mine. Yes, he does love The Color of Money. Wiley's a big fan of it. So, Steve, we kind of touched on these already a little bit. So maybe this came in a little bit later, but do you have any other ones you want to throw in?
Yeah, another one. I literally almost watched it again last night, and I was like, you just watched that a few months ago, and that's Excalibur. I just love Excalibur. Wow. I'll go to it anytime.
Yeah, that's a great choice. Love that score, too. Damn. I guess I would say Top Gun.
Oh, sure. That's one for you. One for me.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Major League is another one that I love to watch. Rocky IV. These are ones that I turn. There's like a lot of 80s films I turn to.
Yeah.
To kind of, help me through. Because you go back to that time when the world still felt possible. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's possibilities when I watch movies from the 80s. There's that theme of like wanting to overcome things, and you're going to show them. Like, Secret of My Success is another one of my closet favorites, right? Because he's like, everyone's telling him he's not going to succeed. He's going to be stuck in the mailroom for the rest of his life. But through a crazy set of circumstances, he ends up in a position where by the end, he is running the company. And so it's amazing, you know? So I love that. Dude,
there's something definitely about going back to your comfort time when you're a kid. Mm-hmm. Those movies that you watched over and over again, it's strange that I want to watch them more. Wrath of Khan being a perfect example. Excalibur, the original Planet of the Apes is another one that I'll go back to all the time. Like, there's just a bunch that are that kind of film. Shawshank Redemption would be another one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Shawshank is so great. All right. Well, let's wrap it up there. We're at over an hour and a half. So thank you all so much for hanging out with us for this live show and for being okay with us having to pivot here to a new topic, as we wanted to kind of talk about stuff through what's going on in LA and the fires. So thank you so much. Thanks for the Streamlabs. Thanks for the super chats. You guys are very kind, a very lively chat today. So thank you so much. Steve, what do we have to tell these wonderful people as we wrap up here?
Well, first of all, I want to echo your thanks for the people that have tuned in and the people that donated so generously to ask some questions. I also want to just put a big, huge thank you to all of the people that are working so hard to help out in Los Angeles right now. And of course, if you can, and there's all sorts of places I'm sure you could give, like the American Red Cross being one of the first ones, but also help with pets and things like that. As far as the Cinephiles is concerned, you can subscribe right here on our YouTube channel, and please like this as well. You could also subscribe to the podcast feed through Spotify or Overcast or Apple Podcasts. On Apple Podcasts, you can support the show for just $4.99 a month, where you can get ad-free versions of the show and access to our Cinephile shorts. You can also support the show on patreon.com/thecinephiles, where you can get those features as well as join our advisory board and listen to our watch-alongs and some other tiers that we have there as well. You can buy or stream every movie we've ever reviewed at cinephiles.net. And I am SR Morris on Twitter and Blue Sky, and SR Morris 1 on Instagram.
Yeah. Before we go, though, Vincent Zawada tossed one in here. Another one is Days of Future Past. Yep. X-Men Days of Future Past, right? People come together from different walks of life, different eras of existence in the history of X-Men to overcome all that by the end. Yeah. It's a great one to suggest. As for me, you can follow me at The Roca Says on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, and Blue Sky, The Outlaw Nation on Twitch. Yes, you subscribe down below. Leave your comments. What are some of your crisis management movies that you like? What are the movies you turn to in times of crisis? Let us know your thoughts there, or tweet at us, or DM us, or X at us, whatever the term is for that that platform there, or Blue Sky us if you want to let us know your thoughts on all of that. As for me, my other YouTube channel, youtube.com/JohnRocaSays. Please head on over there and subscribe there for all the other content I do on this world of the YouTubes and podcasts. Thanks so much. Take care of yourselves. Be well. And I echo Steve's sentiments. Thank you to everyone who's helping in the fires. If you happen to catch this or watch this, and please donate if you can, where you can, to help everybody involved in this and everybody who's suffering through this. It's really, really important. Thank you again. Take care of yourselves. Be well. And we'll talk to you next time with another brand new episode of The Cinephiles. Peace. Until then.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.